Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. It's a great pleasure to have back with us a member of Congress who has been serving in a variety of capacities in that war over a very long period of time, notably 14 years as a career officer in the United States Air Force, including a pilot with world records to his credit. He is also an author of some 17 books, including the New York Times bestseller, The Miracle of Freedom, Seven Tipping Points That Saved the World. He is a businessman as well as now a member of Congress. He serves on the House Appropriations Committee, including its Homeland Security Subcommittee and its State Foreign Operations and Related Programs Subcommittee. He is also a member of the House Intelligence Committee. He is Congressman Chris Stewart, representing the people of the 2nd District of Utah. Congressman, welcome back. It's great to have you with us, sir.
Frank, I look forward to these, so thanks for giving me a few minutes of your time.
The pleasure is all mine. Let's start with a speech that, as we speak, has not yet happened, but that is impending by the Prime Minister of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, to a joint session of Congress. Some of your colleagues are not going to be present. The Obama administration was dead set against this idea. What are your thoughts on both the importance of this speech and, the boycotting and other efforts to undermine it?
For generations now, Republicans and Democrats have been united that Iran would not be allowed to weaponize their programs to build nuclear weapons. And yet the president seems to be taking an approach that not only allows that, it almost guarantees it. I mean, negotiations include a sunset provision that delays them for 10 years. But, you know, two things on that. One is I don't trust them, and I don't think we should trust them. And the second is, even if the treaty is complied with in 10 years, they're free to build their nuclear program at that point. And I don't know. I mean, it's unfortunate that it's become politicized because it hasn't been in the past. It shouldn't be. You know, I think shame on those people who wouldn't come and hear the prime minister speak. What he has to say is important. He certainly has a dog in this fight. And I just think we owe him the respect of hearing his concerns.
You know, you say we can't trust the Iranians, Congressman Stewart, and it seems to me we actually can trust them to do exactly what they've done repeatedly, which is to cheat on any agreement they make, to conceal from us and otherwise try to deceive us about actual capabilities that they're amassing, and to try to act on their repeated threats, not just to wipe Israel off the map, but also to bring about a world without America. It does strike me as unbelievable that anyone is resisting the opportunity to hear from someone who is really on the front lines of this fight.
I have an editorial in the Wall Street Journal this morning on that very issue, and the primary premise is this: can we trust them? To carry further your point, I asked Secretary Kerry last week at a hearing we had. I said, you know, I went down a long list of activities that the Iranians have pursued where they have worked against U.S. interests, where they have killed Americans, where they have, you know, they've been a state sponsor of terrorism for 31 years, Hezbollah, Hamas, including activities in our hemisphere, in South America, and even in Mexico. And then I asked the secretary, can you give me one example of where they have worked in a positive or constructive way with the U.S. or with any of our allies? And he did not have a response to that. I learned when I was in the military, I had the great honor of being part of implementing START II and the treaty with the Russians of the former Soviet Union. And I realized the devil is in the details, but you can make a treaty work if both sides want it to be successful. But I don't believe that Iran wants this to be successful. I think they're using this to forestall and to continue to build us. I just don't understand why we would take such a risk.
Yeah, and again, the risk is not just to an important ally or, for that matter, others in the Middle East, as you understand so well, Congressman Chris Stewart. It is to us here in the United States as well. Let me turn, if I may, to another topic that I know you all are wrestling with as we speak, and that is the resolution of the funding for the Department of Homeland Security, as you also seek, I think, to, and quite properly, to try to prevent the president from acting in an unconstitutional manner, namely by extending amnesty to various illegal alien communities. Where do you think things are going to sort on that? And do you believe that it is important that this unconstitutional behavior be checked?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's so discouraging to me to see this president who seems to think I've got 2 years and I am going to press to the absolute limits. And you've got Harry Reid in the Senate who has said, Mr. President, you press and I will stop him from stopping you. He's frankly as powerful in minority as he was in the majority because all he wants to do is stop the Republicans from trying to put a check on this president. And this isn't an argument over some tax policy or some obscure regulation. It is, as you said, Frank, it is an absolute constitutional necessity that we stop the president. But I don't know how we do that. Talk about a rock and a hard spot. I mean, this is a choice between defunding Homeland Security. And as I sit on the Intelligence Committee, I'm aware on a daily basis of the chaotic and dangerous world we live in, and defending our Constitution. And I can tell you what I think is the primary concern there, and that is I have to defend the Constitution, but it is such a difficult decision for many members.
Well, we certainly understand that. And I guess if there's any comfort in this, if it were to actually result in a temporary defunding, it is a relatively small number of people and what are described as non-critical functions, some 30,000 or so. And while that's a hardship and not desirable, it is certainly preferable to allowing the Constitution really to be eviscerated. And it won't just be in this respect, unfortunately. And let me, in that regard, if I may, Congressman, because there's so much to talk with you about in so little time, you've also written an important piece in the Daily Caller recently about another initiative of this president that I think has very far-reaching implications for, well, possibly First Amendment freedoms, certainly the use of the Internet as a vehicle for communicating them. Talk a little bit, if you would, about your thoughts on this decision that has now been taken by the FCC to effect what they call net neutrality.
Yeah, and isn't that ironically named? You know, they're brilliant at their messaging, net neutrality. Well, who would be against that? It is another example of the president and his broad reach across all of these government agencies. The FCC is supposed to be neutral, and there's no question they were influenced by the administration on this. Not only influenced, but persuaded by the administration on this. And I would ask any of your listeners this very simple question. Do you think the government should be involved in the enterprise of providing Internet service? And why do you possibly think that involving the government would make that better? And if you can get an answer to that, then I would support this. But I don't believe that anyone can. I think the magic of the Internet is that it's free and it's independent, it's private, it's market-driven, and this is going to introduce the heavy hand of government into all of that. And how could that possibly be a good idea?
As I understand it, Congressman Chris Stewart, we're talking about the vehicle that the government would use is essentially a model that dates to the 1930s when we had one single copper wire, you know, monopoly, Ma Bell, as it was called at the time. And that seems so completely at odds with everything that characterizes the Internet today. Plus, as I understand it, it would open the door to what a number of foreign nations who seek to exercise control over the Internet would be able to do pursuant to various treaties once we start regulating it here. Is this something that we can turn around, in your estimation, and if so, how?
It is one of these things we look at and you just shake your head and you go, how do you stop it? How do you stop the FCC? There is legislation in Congress that would address this. And by the way, This isn't a subject that Republicans only agree on. There are Democrats who agree with us on this. Now, there's not many, but I hope there's enough that we could push a bill through the House and the Senate and get it to the president's desk. But unfortunately, I'm not sure that he'll work with us on this.
Congressman, I know we have to let you go, but even in these cases, you've mentioned two of them, you know, where we actually on Israel and I'd like to think on you know, immigration policy, but for sure on the internet, we've had bipartisanship in the past that's being essentially run off the rails at the moment, though, in ways that I'm afraid will redound very much to our detriment. Your service to our country, past, present, and continuing, Congressman Chris Stewart, is deeply appreciated. Thank you for spending a few minutes with us, and I look forward to discussing with you your thoughts after Bibi Netanyahu's speech and on these and other issues in the future. Keep up the great work, and we'll talk with you soon. Next up, Ilan Berman talks about Vladimir Putin's threats to his opposition at home and to the rest of us. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country. The one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved, and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Ilan Berman. He is the vice president at the highly regarded American Foreign Policy Council, the author of numerous books, including Implosion, The End of Russia, and What It Means for America. Ilan is an active contributor to the public policy debate about national security affairs broadly defined, but I'm particularly anxious to talk with him about Russia. Ilan, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Oh, great to be back.
Well, there's a lot troubling happening in Russia at the moment. I don't know if it's evidence of implosion or something else, but let's start with your sense of what the assassination of Boris Nemtsov, a man who was clearly a thorn in the side of Vladimir Putin, might mean both for Russia domestically and perhaps its international conduct as well.
Right. Well, the assassination of Nemtsov, which happened in the late afternoon, our time, late in the evening, Russian time, Moscow time, on Friday, the 27th of February, was a very public statement of intent on the part of what we suspect to be the Kremlin. Again, the fingerprints are not there, but virtually no one who watches political affairs in Russia thinks that anybody other than the Russian president and his political fellow travelers are responsible. And the message is very simple. The ante with regard to the tug of war politically between the Kremlin and its opponents has just gotten raised significantly. Nemtsov was a major opponent. He was more active in recent weeks than he had been previously because of the war in Ukraine and his public opposition to it. And he thought he had immunity because he was part of the old system. He had been a deputy prime minister, and he was operating in Moscow under the assumption of immunity, which had been granted by Vladimir Putin, who succeeded Yeltsin as president, to all of Yeltsin's former employees. And what this shows is that truly no one is safe from the Kremlin.
Yeah. All bets are off when it comes now to opposing Vladimir Putin, and whether his fingerprints literally are on this action or not, the message is unmistakable. We're joined by Ilan Berman of the American Foreign Policy Council. He is its vice president, the author of numerous books on Iran and on totalitarianism, on Russia, and we're specifically interested in his thoughts on what is going on at the moment inside the Kremlin vis-a-vis both its domestic opponents like Boris Nemtsov and also the opposition that it is confronting in Ukraine and, for that matter, from the West to its predations in the eastern part of Ukraine at the moment. And talk, if you would, Ilan, about what you think Putin calculates now is his way forward with respect to Ukraine. There's been a ceasefire of the, you know, latest in several that have been broken. Is there, in fact, any prospect that he will check his ambitions for greater territorial expansionism at Ukraine's expense?
Well, my read is that no, he won't. And I think the proper way to understand what Russia is doing and not doing in Ukraine is to think about it as part of a multi-part process. This is a there's an old Russian parable that says that the appetite comes with the eating. And I think you see this with regard to Russian behavior. The more advances Russia takes without having a serious response, either from the Ukrainian government or the West, the more emboldened it becomes to think bigger, to think about more territorial acquisition. Ukraine isn't the start of this process. You could argue that the process started in 2008 with the Russian war with neighboring Georgia over the autonomous regions of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. And as a result of that conflict, those regions are essentially Russian protectorates now. Ukraine is very much in the same mold. And there is an expectation. There's a tremendous fear on the part of the Baltic states, and I think a well-justified one, that Russia's ambitions territorially aren't going to end in Ukraine. And they're particularly not going to end in Ukraine if there's not a unified Western response on the part of aid, on the part of NATO military operations. If we don't put our money where our mouth is in a concrete sense, Russia's going to be emboldened to take more.
Yeah. You've written about this very powerfully at National Review Online in a piece entitled Russia's Aggression Undeterred by Ceasefires, and you point out that Putin has made no secret of his ambitions to, as you say, reconstitute an empire. And this has to come at the expense, most obviously, of those in what he calls the near abroad, perhaps including NATO allies. What break is there as a practical matter at the moment, Ilan Berman, on that possibility that the Russian appetite will in fact extend to former Soviet republics that have now become formally part of the NATO alliance?
Well, right now, not much. And I think it's necessary to sort of to break up the rhetoric and separate it from what's really happening on the ground. The NATO alliance has made all sorts of big promises about responding to Russian aggression. They have plans to build at least half a dozen new military bases in Eastern Europe. They have plans to stand up a joint expeditionary force to respond to Russian aggression rapidly. But the reality is that this is an unfunded mandate. Most of NATO's money comes from very few countries, and most of all, it comes from the United States. So this is really a project that the Obama administration needs to get behind. And if you look at what Obama has done so far with regard to Ukraine, he has been deliberately minimalist in his approach because, among other things, we need Russia's good behavior, we need Russia's compliance on things like hammering out a nuclear deal with Iran. This isn't the only reason why we don't have a robust Russia policy, but it's certainly a contributing factor. We know that the reset that the Obama administration has pursued with Russia since 2009 is well and truly dead. What we don't know yet is what U.S. policy should be.
And we don't see much fruit from the concessions that have been made here in terms of real contributions by Russia to a satisfactory deal with Iran. As we're speaking, Bibi Netanyahu is addressing the Congress and laying out the case rather starkly for why the deal that the president is now hammering out is really a bug's game and going to leave us with, at best, a breakout not too far down the road, and at worst, a fully ensconced nuclear weapons program. And either way, it's no thanks to the Russians. Let me ask you, Ilan, because you said something in this piece at National Review Online that's tremendously important, I think, to our calculations here. You talk about Turkey being unreliable, Spain seemingly interested in opting out, Greece now with a communist government as a practical matter, certainly deeply sympathetic to the Russians, and as you've indicated, profound under-resourcing. The Germans have had some of their crack units training with broomsticks. I mean, literally, a throwback to, you know, the interwar period of the United States. Is it, in fact, the case, as an expert on Russia, that Vladimir Putin is looking at all of this and simply licking his chops?
No, I think that's right. The Russians understand very well. They look at numbers just as intensively as we do, and they understand very well that what NATO has sketched out as a response to Russian aggression is mostly conceptual. It is not actual. The money isn't there. The reality is that even if the money is there, it's not clear the political will is there because, as you mapped out, from Turkey to Spain to Greece, there are significant intellectual fissures within the NATO alliance itself. And so if you're sitting in Moscow and you're looking at this geopolitical chessboard, you can be forgiven for thinking that the world over the long term is going to turn your way.
Yeah. At the very least, you have an opportunity to shape how that world turns that didn't seem so obvious not so long ago. And especially at a time when we're told that the Russian economy is in tatters because of, well, Saudi manipulation of the oil market for the moment, that Russia seems to be playing a hand rather well. And I'm afraid at the expense of freedom-loving people. Ilan Berman, you stand for those freedom-loving people and speak so clearly on these matters. We're very appreciative of what you do at the American Foreign Policy Council and in your writings, both at book length, notably your book about Russia's implosion, and of course your periodical contributions. Keep it up and come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Andy McCarthy joins us next. We'll talk with him about Bibi's speech and what's up with Hillary Clinton. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn.
Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Today, the leader of the free world will be addressing freedom-loving people everywhere from a bully pulpit in Washington, D.C. Unfortunately, that leader is no longer Barack Obama. Instead, it is Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel. He will be speaking from the podium of a joint session of Congress, and he will be telling the truth about the existential threat facing the free world, including his country and ours, from a nuclear-armed Iran. Bibi's speech is critically needed because of the failure of leadership Mr. Obama has displayed in his stated goal of preventing the emergence of that threat. Unless we follow Mr. Netanyahu's lead, rather than the seductive enabling of Iran inherent in our president's diplomacy, the free world and each of us will be imperiled. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here.
Do this better than any station in town.
Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Frank Affney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is the high point of my week, the visit we have each week, happily, with Andy McCarthy, the former federal prosecutor turned pundit extraordinaire and best-selling author. You can find his writings at National Review Online and PJ Media, among other places. He is also the author, as I say, of Willful Blindness, The Grand Jihad, Faithless Execution, and more. An extraordinary resource, and we're always privileged to have him with us. Andy, welcome back.
Frank, thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
The moment we find ourselves speaking at is in the run-up to the address that Benjamin Netanyahu is to make to the Congress of the United States. While we don't know exactly what he's going to say, what do you anticipate, and what do you think its abiding importance might be?
Well, I think, Frank, from the get-go, and I'm going to now shockingly say something that I've been saying for I don't know how many years, but I haven't got a good answer on it yet, which is how you can have a negotiation with Iran on its nuclear weapons program, which is precisely what it is, that you engage in only because Iran is the world's number one state sponsor of terrorism, and yet the premise of the negotiations, the assumptions on which they go forward, totally disconnect Iran's state sponsorship of terrorism with its nuclear program, so that Iran hasn't been pressed in any way
You know, there's lots of talk about centrifuges and spent fuel and the role of Russia and all this other jazz. But the one thing that everybody cares the most about is the prospect of a regime that practices and sponsors terrorism having nuclear weapons. So I would imagine that Prime Minister Netanyahu, whose country and whose people are more immediately threatened by that prospect, will hammer home the absurdity of engaging in negotiation with a state that not only hasn't forsworn the use of terrorism, but actually is having military exercises even as these negotiations go on, where they, you know, practice blowing up American ships.
This really is such an affront, and clearly so calculatedly an affront. It's kind of, in its way, comparable to the diplomatic affront that apparently John Kerry, among others, has been subjected to, of having their Iranian counterparts screaming at them in the course of these various negotiations, where we are evidently endlessly making concessions. It can only embolden adversaries like these, Andy McCarthy, and heavens knows these aren't the sorts of people that you want to encourage in their aggressive designs. Talk, if you would, a little bit about something you wrote about earlier this week with respect to the Bush doctrine for dealing with jihadists of various stripes and making a small amendment, but an important one, to that doctrine.
Well, I think, Frank, that all this talk about how we don't have a strategy for dealing with the global jihadist threat loses the point that we've had a strategy for 14 years. We simply haven't had the, at any point, and more far away now than ever, the gumption to follow it, which is the doctrine that President Bush announced only days after the 9/11 attacks, which addressed the two things that have to be addressed. Number one, that you hunt down, capture, and kill terrorists wherever on earth they operate, because we know that when they have safe havens to plan and plot, they attack America and American interests. And you have to treat state sponsors of terrorism as enemies of the United States, just as we treat terrorists. And that doesn't mean we have to invade every single country, but we have to make very clear in our policy that those regimes are enemies of the United States, and we are going to work until they either are gone or mend their ways. So I think, unfortunately, that policy has never been followed with the zest that it was announced with. And I think the caveat that has to be added, although it should have been obvious enough when the policy was announced, is that we have to be realistic about what the ideology is that is driving the terrorism, because that's what tells us who the rogue regimes are. I think if you're a state that promotes Sharia supremacism, then you have to be regarded as aiding the enemy, and you are not a friend of the United States, and we ought to organize our policy that way.
Could we just name a few names here, Andy, just to be specific?
I would say, Frank, and this is the one that you know, that rankles people, but it's simply a fact. In Saudi Arabia, where 15 of the 19 9/11 hijackers come from, people remember a few months back when ISIS beheaded three Western journalists, and that got everybody spun up, and appropriately so. I'd simply point out that in the same month that they did that, Saudi Arabia beheaded eight of its prisoners under the Sharia law, that is the law of Saudi Arabia, and yet we regard the Saudis, who are, I think, a big part of the problem, as an important moderate counterterrorism ally, which I continue to find mind-boggling.
Yeah, reliable is another word that is often applied to them. I couldn't agree with you more, Andy. And, you know, it goes without saying that Qatar would fall into that category, and Turkey, it seems, as well.
Turkey in particular, which is one of the biggest sponsors in the world, both materially and morally, of Hezbollah and Hamas, that they are a NATO partner of the United States, not just regarded as a counterterrorism ally, but a NATO partner, is just, it's remarkable.
Remarkable and self-defeating, I think, is your point. Andy, let me switch gears. You have written about Hillary Rodham Clinton in connection with the latest revelations from Judicial Watch a remarkable organization which seems to be ferreting out information that is eluding any number of congressional investigators, notably in connection with the Benghazi scandal. Talk a bit about what we now know as a result of, albeit redacted, emails that they came upon through their Freedom of Information Act requests.
Well, Frank, I think what we've learned through Judicial Watch's good work and their dogged pursuit of documents that the government plainly doesn't want to give up is that from the first minutes of the Benghazi terrorist attack in which four American officials, including our ambassador, were killed, the State Department knew that it was, in fact, a terrorist attack. And, in fact, within a couple of hours, they knew that Ansar al-Sharia, which is the local al-Qaeda affiliate in Libya, had taken credit for the attack. It shouldn't be too much of a revelation, because we knew through some of the congressional testimony that came out, particularly from Greg Hicks, who was the number two official in the State Department in Libya, that the quote-unquote anti-Muslim video that was, according to the State Department, the cause of all this, was a non-factor in Libya and in Benghazi. So we knew that they were getting briefed. They knew that it was a terrorist attack from the start. We knew that from the testimony. But it's quite another thing to see the paper trail come in and show that they knew this was a terrorist attack from the very first moments of it, notwithstanding that they labored day and night for days and weeks afterwards to suggest that it was not a terrorist attack and that it had in fact been caused by this obscure video.
Yeah. I mean, the scandal gets more outrageous by the day. Andy, one other quick question to you. There are press reports that Hillary Rodham Clinton did not use an official government email address during her entire tenure as Secretary of State. Is it striking to you, as it is to me, that this revelation is only getting to our attention at this point? And what are the implications of that, as you see it, for her forthcomingness in terms of the Benghazi investigation and so much more?
Well, I think the lack of an email trail, Frank, is astonishing given the number of investigations that were done here. And it's a commentary on how really poorly done those investigations had to have been. Not that that should be surprising since they didn't come up with anything. But I think it's of a piece with the fact that we have evidence that they were obstructing the investigation even back at the State Department internal investigation stage, where there's indications that they were poaching documents before turning them over to the investigators.
The scandal just becomes deeper and more outrageous by the day. Andy McCarthy, you are on the case as ever. We appreciate your clarity of vision in all of this murk and for sharing it with us each week. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Next up, we'll be speaking with Dr. Peter Pham about the global jihad's manifestations in Africa and whether it may be coming to a mall near you. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We will never fully understand what we've asked of our military service members, of their families, or their children, asking them to deploy, patrol, stay on watch, on point, asking them to put themselves in harm's way, to endure it all. But we do understand that it's our turn, our duty, to bring them all the way home, to keep them secure, to have their backs for the rest of their lives. Wounded Warrior Project long-term support programs do whatever it takes to help our most severely ill or injured veterans live independently, at no cost, for life, so that they might stand at ease. Find out how you can help at findwwp.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm a firefighter.
A teacher.
I'm a farmer.
I'm a barber.
A waitress. A mom.
We're all part of your community. Every day we move in and out of each other's busy lives.
It's easy to take for granted all the little moments that make up our everyday.
Some are good,
others not so much.
But that's life. It's when you experience a moment of uncertainty, something or someone's behavior that doesn't seem quite right.
These are the moments to take a pause.
Because if something doesn't feel right, it's probably not.
It's not about paranoia.
Or being afraid.
It's about standing up and protecting our communities.
One detail at a time.
Because a lot of little details can become a pattern.
We
trust our instincts.
Just like you should.
Because only you know what's not supposed to be in your everyday.
So protect your everyday.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Dr. J. Peter Pham. He is the director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, one of the country's preeminent authorities on the continent of Africa, co-author, I should say, of a book entitled Somalia, Fixing Africa's Most Failed State. We'll be talking about Somalia with him in the course of our conversation. Dr. Pham, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Oh, Frank, it's always a pleasure.
There is a lot going on in Africa these days, and a lot of it seems not to be very good. I guess there have been some improvements made in the Ebola fight, but not so much on the Islamist front. Talk a bit about what's happening at the moment in terms of Boko Haram's operations, both in its home country of Nigeria and some of the neighboring states.
Certainly. If we'd been talking about a month ago, Frank, I would have been extremely pessimistic about Boko Haram. At the time, the group had scored, on top of its gains last year, scored a number of impressive gains in Nigeria, seizing control at the end of January of several towns that had populations, considerable populations. We're talking about 100,000, 110,000 people falling under the rule of a group that is not only a jihadist Islamist group, but one with almost unrestrained brutality. Its use of young girls as young as 7, 10 years of age as carriers of bombs. I wouldn't call them suicide bombers because we're not talking about people who are deciding to do this. We're talking about children being sent laden with explosives into crowded settings.
And then detonated by remote control.
By remote control. And so extraordinary. And this is the group, of course, who last year burst onto international attention by its seizure of over 200 young girls from a school. So it was making rather impressive gains on the military front. Fortunately, there's some good news to report. That shocked Nigeria and its neighbors into kind of out of a bit of a stupor and into action. And in the last few weeks, we've seen a number of towns retaken by the Nigerian military, as well as militaries from Chad, Niger, and Cameroon. So there's been a rollback. The group is still, however, very, very powerful, very, very virulent, and we're seeing increasing signs of at least tentative connections to the so-called Islamic State, and that's a worrying indicator. This is a group that has transformed itself, that has evolved very, very rapidly. It hasn't had those links before, but links are now emerging, and that's a real point of contention that could very well be a game changer here.
Yeah. This, of course, is happening elsewhere in Africa as well, notably in Libya at the moment, with Islamic State operatives apparently operating in more or less a safe haven there and threatening Europe. So it's just further evidence of truly the global nature of this jihad. Peter Pham, let me ask you about another of the Islamist operations that has been causing both the nations of Africa and increasingly others beyond concern, namely Al-Shabaab, based in Somalia. There have been reports that they have now targeted the Mall of America in the United States and other large commercial centers in other countries in the West. Do you credit that as a realistic threat, or is this sort of the evidence of the death throes of an operation that is also being rolled up?
Well, I wouldn't say the death throes so much, Frank, as the transformation or the completion of the transformation of a group. The last few years, Al-Shabaab, which at one time held control of most of the territory of what was once Somalia, has been rolled back on the ground by a combination of internationally backed African Union troops from Uganda, Burundi, joined later by Kenya and Ethiopia. They've rolled it back militarily. It's lost a lot of territory. It's been severely degraded, and it's also lost a lot of support because of its own incompetence and its brutality. That being said, however, the leadership of the group, which had always been perhaps more radical than the members, in fact, some of the leaders, including the late Amir Ahmed Godane, had fought with Al-Qaeda and other extremist jihadist groups in South Asia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Kashmir. Godane was killed by a U.S. Special Operations Forces strike in September. The group, however, he had set it on evolution to transform, less interested in controlling Somalia and more in becoming a true terrorist organization. It was under this late leader, Godane, when in 2012, al-Shabaab formally affiliated with al-Qaeda under Ayman al-Zawahiri. Now, the threat to the group, on one hand, it's degraded military. It's less of a military threat to the East African countries, but it's shown in the last year and a half that it's more of a terrorist threat. We saw in 2013 the attack on the Westgate Mall in Nairobi. A little less attention in the media in North America and Europe have been the ongoing attacks targeting specifically Christians, in fact, in Kenya, especially the northeastern part of Kenya, attacks in Somalia almost on a weekly basis, suicide attacks on civilians, upon the international community. And now this threat in this video, this call, incitement to attacks on the Mall of America, shopping centers in Canada, as well as the UK. And where this is a real threat, on one hand, it's a call for attention. Clearly, this is a group that's down on its luck militarily and seeking attention. But beyond that, we have to realize, unlike other jihadist groups, Shabaab has shown a record of being able to reach, even if only a minority, but still a consistent minority within the large Somali American diaspora. There have been Americans, citizens, and permanent residents who have gone to Somalia to fight for al-Shabaab. There have been people who have been prosecuted for helping such fighters go or for soliciting material support for Shabaab. So even if they're only a minority, there is still within the community that minority, that's however small of a number of people who have clearly demonstrated an allegiance to al-Shabaab. And it only takes one of those individuals to act to have a real tragedy.
Yeah, and we're, of course, very concerned about large numbers of Somalis in the vicinity of Mall of America who could conceivably be part of the pool from which such an individual or individuals might be drawn. In your estimation then, Peter Pham, is that threat a credible one to, you know, facilities in the West, Mall of America or others here, for example? Or do you think that this is basically just sort of a Hail Mary pass to see if anybody might be at the receiving end?
Well, I think, unfortunately, time alone will tell whether it's a, if you will, an order to a sleeper cell that's lying in wait out there, or it's merely an incitement. Either way, I think we have to be on especially vigilant, because this is a group, unlike other jihadist groups, this is a group that has shown in the past that it does indeed have networks, however small, but still existent, networks of support within the American homeland. You know, just by the way, just in the last few days, U.S. authorities have acknowledged that captured one of the FBI's top 10 most wanted, a former cab driver in the D.C. suburbs, Liban Haji Muhammad, who's been sought by the FBI. He's been found in Somalia and hopefully will be extradited back for trial here. But again, that someone in the D.C. suburbs was top 10 most wanted by the FBI for his links to al-Shabaab.
Yeah. And, you know, what this really calls to mind, Peter Pham, is the possibilities that people in those sorts of service industries in this country, and there are large numbers of them, could well be among the recruits to this kind of global jihad. And that is something I fear we are not as alive to as a danger as we should be. This is a subject we will be returning to, I know, and you are covering very closely, Peter Pham, at the Atlantic Council. Thank you for taking some time to go over these important developments with us. We look forward to visiting again with you on this subject very soon. We look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.